I described this summer as like a breath of fresh air after you're being held underwater by a wave. It just felt like I had this month of reprieve where things were semi-normal and we were vaccinated, even though my kids couldn't be vaccinated. The case rates were pretty low here. And now it just feels like it's all coming back. And I feel a little foolish for even having that, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months, whatever, where I felt relieved and optimistic.
That's Jessica Gross. She's a mother of two and a New York Times parenting columnist. A little later in the show, I'll talk with her and three other moms about how they've been doing during the pandemic and whether this time can be a turning point for how we value motherhood. First, though, we head to the box office for some film reviews with Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
And Tim Gerson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of This Is How You Make a Movie. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with a movie called Free Guy. It's a video game inspired action flick. It stars Ryan Reynolds as a naive bank teller named Guy. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Hey, bud, you ever think that there's got to be more?
More than what?
Stuff we do day after day. Being shot at, run over, taken hostage.
Everybody down on the ground.
Today's gonna be different.
He's just resting.
In pieces. That man is dead.
Katie, let's begin with you. What is the premise?
So Free Guy is about the NPC, the non-player character in a video game. So I'm not a gamer. I assume that when you are playing a video game, you run in, you know, you're playing Grand Theft Auto, you run in, you rob a bank, and there's like various characters around, and mm-hmm. that is who Guy is. So he is just sort of a simple guy who lives his life and in this video game world. But then at the same time, there is this real world conflict going on, and one day he sees a beautiful player and he becomes infatuated with her, which is not something that he's supposed to do. He's not supposed to have that code in his algorithm. So mm-hmm. it becomes this strange story where he is trying to pursue her and he becomes this sensation within the game. And she is a player in the real world who is actually a game designer who's trying to find some of what she believes is her own code, her own intellectual property that's been placed inside of this game. Free Guy, it's interesting. My whole thing with Free Guy is like, you will like it if you buy what Ryan Reynolds is selling, and I'm not buying what Ryan Reynolds is selling.
Well, normally we are, right? He's like, you know, super likable.
Yeah, I don't know. I find his persona to be very smarmy and glib, and they definitely mm-hmm. sort of, this movie is very sort of glib in that way. And I don't really buy him as the romantic lead for Jodie Comer, who's playing Molotov Girl.
Love her.
You know, so I love her.
And there is, they, yeah.
Yes, they do manage to salvage that a little bit. I was a little turned off by Free Guy, but I know a lot of people are having fun with it. And I'm sure gamers will really enjoy it because it really speaks to that culture.
Tim?
I didn't have fun with it either, no. I think the concept is clever, and it's sort of a Truman Show / Purple Rose of Cairo, like Groundhog mm-hmm. Day kind of thing going on in the movie, you know, because this character Guy does not know that he's in a video game. He just thinks his world that he lives in is the real world, and he finds out through the course of the film that, no, he's in a game, and he is actually not real. And so what is potentially interesting is that Ryan Reynolds, the persona that Kitty's talking about, is this is a chance for him to be, because he's actually not a real person, he's just a video game character, he has to convince Molotov Girl that he is real, that he actually does have real feelings and real emotions. That requires a certain amount of sincerity, which Ryan Reynolds has been able to do in bits and pieces in other movies in his career, like Mississippi Grind and some other things. But the sincerity he has to pull off in this movie, I don't think entirely works. I also think that beyond the concept of it's a video game, he does not know he's in a video game. I think that's really fun for the first 15 minutes, but the movie is 2 hours long, and I think that there's not enough forward momentum and enough fun ideas. Beyond that, there's also this ridiculously uninteresting subplot in the real world where Comer's character is trying to find proof that this other game developer stole her idea. That becomes mm-hmm. more and more important as the film goes along. I don't think anybody who is going to go see Free Guy is interested in video game property theft. I don't think anybody wants to see a movie about that. I don't know. I'm not Sean Levy who directed the movie. Maybe he knows these things better than I do. But that's the plot really kind of drains the energy out of the movie. And it's just not funny enough. The romance is not bad. They have some chemistry, but overall I just felt like they're repurposing a lot of older ideas but putting it into the world of a video game.
Okay, Free Guy, if you want, is out in theaters this weekend. Moving on to a new horror film. It's called Don't Breathe 2. It's a follow-up to a 2016 film centered around a blind veteran. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Remember, the guy's blind, but he's still dangerous.
Find the girl.
Now, you're gonna see what I see.
Ooh. Okay, Katie, you saw this one. Tim, you skipped this one. Katie, what did you think?
I had a blast, but I will say that I am a horror movie lover. I adore them. I really had fun with this. The first Don't Breathe was kind of a surprise. It was this really smart concept about this blind veteran and these kids who break into his house. At the end, they reveal something very disturbing in his basement, but it was very well crafted. It's made by a team of Uruguayan filmmakers. Fede Alvarez directed the first Don't Breathe, and the writer and producer of the first Don't Breathe, Rodo Sadeguez, he directs Don't Breathe 2. So it's the same team working on it. And I think there's some really good craft on display here, just in terms of the cinematography and the suspense that they build. In this film, the blind man, who's played by Stephen Lang, is living in a new house. He's raising a young girl as his daughter and teaching her sort of self-defense and survivalist skills. And wouldn't you guess it, there is another home invasion, this time led by a really nasty group of guys. So these villains are so awful and bad that you root for the Stephen Lang blind man character, even though he is a bad guy, because the other villains are so much worse. And I can't stress enough, it is very disturbing, very, very disturbing and super violent, incredibly gory. This is for the gore heads, the horror heads like me. So, yeah.
Anyway, so Don't Breathe 2 in theaters this weekend. Up next, a new Aretha Franklin biopic. It stars Jennifer Hudson as Aretha, and it's called Respect, of course. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Honey, find the songs that move you. Until you do that, you ain't going nowhere.
I want to sing what I want to sing.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Okay. Find out what means to me.
You really like it?
We love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Aretha Franklin.
All right, Tim, there is a lot of Aretha around lately. There was that National Geographic series starring Cynthia Erivo. What did you think of this one?
Without having seen the Erivo series, I think this is just okay. I think it has that biopic problem. It spans about 20 years. Jennifer Hudson plays Aretha Franklin, and the film chronicles her rise and then some of the early setbacks that happen once she becomes an alcoholic and she starts to deal with the family and childhood issues that she had repressed as a child. They're coming up now that she's becoming more successful. I think Jennifer Hudson, obviously she has a terrific singing voice. Nobody disputes that. What I think is difficult is that as powerful a voice as Jennifer Hudson has, it is, I think, different than Aretha Franklin's voice. And to be fair, probably nobody could capture Aretha Franklin's singing voice. It's so unique. It's so wonderful. But I also felt like in terms of the performance that she gives as Franklin, she's kind of hampered by a script, and this goes to the biopic problem. It is a movie where you get a sense of a life, but you get more of a sense of this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. It feels more like a greatest hits reel as opposed to really like a character that you feel like is being developed and explored. It's a decent sort of introduction to her, but if anybody I think is a real fan of her and her work, I think the movie's kind of lacking.
Katie?
Yeah, I agree with Tim. I found it pretty uneven. It definitely suffers from the biopic tropes. I felt like, you know, we get this whole first act where Sky Dakota Turner is playing Aretha Franklin as a young child. And I just could have cut that whole thing. I think Sky Dakota Turner is great and fantastic actress, and she gives a lovely performance. But I just don't know why we have to start in 1952. And then the movie is 2.5 hours long. And it does feel like it is just trying to like hit these beats. And then somehow 1968 is like a third of the movie. It just felt really wildly uneven to me. And I think we're all there to see Jennifer Hudson sing Aretha Franklin songs. And there wasn't enough of that for me. I think the movie ends on this really beautiful, amazing moment, which is the recording of the Amazing Grace album. Mm-hmm. And that to me was this like wonderful, you know, moment, and it was beautifully shot, beautifully performed, but there just wasn't enough of that throughout the whole film.
So maybe skip it and go see that documentary, Amazing Grace, which
I was just gonna say, yeah, Amazing Grace, which is on Hulu and also available for like rental at other places. The movie ends, spoiler alert, with that concert, like Kitty is talking about, and it just makes you want to watch the concert film, which is really amazing.
Which is great.
It's only like an 85-minute film. It's one of my favorite documentaries of the last few years. I highly, highly recommend it.
Okay, our final film today is called CODA. It's an acronym for Child of Deaf Adults. It's about a child of deaf adults. She's a young singer, and she wants to pursue her dream of music, but she has to choose between her family and that dream. We've heard that plot twist before. Here is a clip from the trailer.
You're the girl with the deaf family?
Yeah.
And you sing. Interesting. I've been coaching for Berklee College of Music. I can help you get a scholarship.
I want to do this.
There are plenty of pretty voices with nothing to say. Do you have something to say?
Okay, Tim, does the movie have something to say?
It does have something to say. I mean, as you pointed out, there are some shop-worn elements to this story, but there's a lot of heart, and it's a feel-good movie that actually does make you feel good. It's set in the fishing community in Massachusetts. It stars Amelia Jones, who plays Ruby. She is the only member of her family who can hear. She is the child of deaf adults. She has two parents and an older brother who are all deaf. They all work on this fishing boat together. So she works on the fishing boat in the morning. She goes to school during the day, and she loves her family. But she also has this amazing singing voice. And one day she takes a singing class, like a music class, and her music teacher realizes, you have this amazing voice. You should really consider making this a career. You should apply to the Berklee College of Music. And so she's torn because not only does she love her family and wants to support her family because she's the only member of her family who can hear, their family business may flounder. And so she has to kind of make these choices between her family and what maybe she wants in her own life. I have some reservations about CODA on the whole, but when the thing is over, I was as moved as I think as anybody else will be when they watch this.
Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, those heartstrings, my heartstrings were tugged all the way. I was completely moved. I loved this movie so much. I spent the last half hour just sobbing through it. And it won the Sundance Audience Award and the Jury Award. And like, it just works. And yeah, it's not breaking the mold on the story. It's completely, you know, we've seen this before. You know, there are certain predictable elements, but it just works and flows so beautifully. Amelia Jones is wonderful. The family is great. They're hilarious. And the song, I just cry when people sing. So she sings some beautiful Joni Mitchell songs, and it was very heartwarming to me. And it is a crowd pleaser. It's not, you know, super innovative, but I think Sean Hader just does a great job, you know, making it all work together, and the lead performance is just fantastic. So I love this movie, and I think a lot of other people are going to love it too. So, yeah.
And you don't have to leave your house to see it. It's on Apple TV Plus. So there's that too.
Yes.
All right. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you.
Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times, and Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of the book, This Is How You Make a Movie. coming up, the Friday conversation. Today, how COVID changed motherhood.
My daughter said, I would like to start cooking mainly because I'm tired of you cooking the same things because you're stressed out. And surrendering that to her has been the biggest blessing. And being honest about the fact that I ain't taking that back. After this pandemic, you still gonna be in that kitchen.
Four working moms on the last year and a half, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's hard enough to be a mom without a global pandemic, but then factor in lost jobs, reduced hours, trying to work from home while taking care of a kid who spends their days in front of a screen on Zoom school. Now add in anxiety about sending kids back to school and a late summer COVID surge when kids under 12 still aren't eligible for vaccines. Moms are really in crisis right now. And to talk about this, we've assembled four mothers from across the country to talk about how they're doing and about whether the pandemic can create a turning point nationally, a reevaluation of how we value motherhood on a larger level, on a policy level. Jennifer Haynes is a caterer and single mom of two twin boys in Rancho Cucamonga, and welcome to Press Play.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Also joining us is Jessica Gross. She's a parenting columnist at the New York Times, editor of their series, The Primal Scream, and author of the forthcoming book, All Powerful and Totally Useless, The Creation of the Ideal American Mother. She has two young daughters. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Nice to have you back. Thea Monnier is a family therapist in Pasadena and the mother of three teenage girls. Welcome, Thea.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you, too. And Hema Zamaro is an economist at the University of Arkansas, and she also teaches at USC. She's done a lot of research into how the pandemic has hit women hard, especially working moms. She's a mother herself of two elementary-age children. Welcome, Hema.
Hi, thank you.
All right. Now that we have you all with us, Jennifer, let's begin with you. Just to remind listeners, you are the caterer and the mom of two boys, 12-year-olds. How have you been doing? What's life been like as a single mom during this pandemic?
It's definitely been a little crazy. I'm one of those moms who is just huge on self-care and making sure that I can step away and take off my hat, you know, working from home and being home with them at the same time. It's like required for me to change my scenery. And so for a year and a half, I have not been able to do that. So it's been a little challenging for sure, but I'm trying to make the best of it. But it's definitely been crazy in my house for sure.
Right. And the kids are at home learning from, you know, remotely, as most of our kids have been this past year, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And one of your sons has autism?
Yes, I do. One of my boys is autistic and they learn completely differently. So it's been an all day thing just to be able to comfort them and to give them what they need individually because it's so different. And, you know, with children at that age, they have to have that attention from you. They need to be able to have the time and patience in order to help them be successful because obviously this pandemic has affected our children in a crazy way as well, not being able to play with friends and connect. And so it's been a well-rounded job by itself, aside from work.
Right. And so you're doing this all on your own.
Yes.
The boy's father isn't really in the picture.
No, he actually lives out of state and has not been consistent in their lives since they were born.
Wow. So you really are working very, very hard. What has happened to your catering business during this time?
Well, it completely shut down. My last day of catering was actually March 14th of 2020. With the pandemic, there have been no events, and that's where I make literally 95% of my income from catering events from 75 to 150 people. And so I tried to redo my model and do online cooking classes, which I did pick up a few clients, but nothing in comparison to be able to replace what I lost from having to close. And I still am not back open to this day.
Oh my gosh. Jessica, I want to bring you in on this because you interview a lot of moms like Jennifer, and they have weighed in the Primal Scream series at the New York Times. What you hear there, is it something that you've heard a lot this past year and a half?
Absolutely, over and over again. And I have particularly heard from moms whose kids have a variety of disabilities that it is particularly hard on them and that they feel abandoned by their school districts in many cases. And moms are still just not okay. I talk to them every day. I think certainly things are not quite as bleak as they were in, you know, the nadir of, you know, April, May, June, 2020. But overall, they still have to do the majority of domestic work, the majority of childcare, and the majority of them still have paid work outside the home. And trying to do all of those things at all the same time is just much worse than it was before the pandemic. So I think we just piled this much harder kind of experience on an experience of American parenting that was already much more difficult than it had to be.
And what about you? You're a parent yourself. Are you okay?
I am. I have two girls. They are 5 and 8. I described this summer as like a breath of fresh air after you're being held underwater by a wave. I've also been watching a lot of surfing documentaries, if you can't tell. They've been at in-person camp and they have been so happy. And I see Delta just rising up as they go back to school this fall, and school in New York State starts much later than it does in California. So they're not back until September 13th. But it just felt like I had this month of reprieve where things were semi-normal and we were vaccinated, even though my kids couldn't be vaccinated. The case rates were pretty low here. And now it just feels like it's all coming back. And I feel a little foolish for even having that, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months, whatever, where I felt relieved and optimistic.
Yeah, you feel like a chump. Like it's like, oh my God, how could I let myself think that possibly we're going back to normal times when...
Totally, a little bit chumpy.
We clearly are going in the wrong direction. Hema, let me bring you in on this. You are in Arkansas, and I understand that you also sent your kids to camp. And was that a breath of fresh air for you?
It was very short breath air in Arkansas. As you know, cases with Delta started going up already in July. So I feel like we just had the chance to leave the house for a couple of weeks and then we had to go back in. So we didn't have that feeling of a break at all. So it feels like we are in the same state that we were nonstop for the last year and a half.
And your kids are 8 and 10 years old?
Yes.
And so in Arkansas, it's a different situation than either in here in California or in New York, where Jessica is, in that there is no mask mandate for kids or anyone.
Yeah, so the last, fortunately, that's changed as of last week. So it's been nerve-wracking because we start school next Monday.
You are an economist, so I want to have you put on your economist hat for a second, take off your mom hat for a minute. I mean, gosh, that's what we're all doing, right? Taking on and off our mom hats, which is why we're talking about this. It's a little difficult to do sometimes. Talk a little bit about how women have done overall economically in this past year and a half. Jennifer really illustrated the problems. She had to shut down her catering business and has struggled financially ever since. How many women are in her situation?
Yeah, so what we have seen is that this pandemic has brought an economic crisis that is different from many prior crises. So in before, most of the economic crisis affected more male-dominated sectors. And what we have seen with the pandemic is that it has affected a lot the service sector where more women work. So especially women, and in particular women of color, have been hit very hard. And also, if you add the school closures and the need to teach your kids at home and the increased childcare needs, and the fact that women have been taking much more of a heavier load in the provision of childcare than men, even in two-parent households, moms have been doing most of the work. What we see is that for once they lost more jobs, but also it's taking them much more time to recover and find another job.
Mm-hmm. What does that do psychologically? And I want to bring in Thea right now, Thea Monnier, family therapist in Pasadena, also a mom of three teenage girls. And I imagine that your clients, without revealing anything that is identifying and personal information, are expressing this to you, that this kind of mental stress that this has brought on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think particularly when we think about the mythology around motherhood, there's this sort of similar to what Jessica's book is called, like all powerful, all knowing. You're supposed to have all the answers. You're supposed to know exactly what to do. I mean, even your partners are looking to you for that if you're in the mother role. So this state of uncertainty, which in truth, we're always uncertain. Like those of us who've been mothering for a while know it's kind of a crapshoot most of the time. But this is a different level of uncertainty, right? This is like not being able to give your kid or yourself certain assurances, right? We kind of have spoken about it even here when Jessica talks about feeling foolish for even, you know, believing that this thing could be over. And I think those are the kind of things that we hold ourselves to all the time. Like, you know, how could we have possibly known? We're all running off of data that we're receiving from an absurd amount of sources at this point. And I think it's definitely unleashed and revealed some deep, deep vulnerability and some cracks in that mythology that in truth, like you mentioned before, were there before the pandemic, right? Mothers were stressed out, too much was being put on them, too much was being asked of them, but the pandemic has definitely widened those cracks.
That's Thea Monnier, a family therapist in Pasadena. She's also the mom of three teenage girls. We're having a big conversation this hour with her and three other moms, a caterer, an economist, a journalist, about how they're doing during the pandemic and whether this moment represents a turning point for motherhood. Let's take a short break and we'll talk some more. I'm Madeline Brand and this is Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm speaking with three women this hour who have a lot to say about what it's like to be a mom in the pandemic, how much more has fallen on the shoulders of working women with children. Jessica Gross writes a parenting column for the New York Times, and she's working on a book called All Powerful and Totally Useless, The Creation of the Ideal American Mother. She has two young daughters. Jennifer Haynes is a caterer and a single mom of two boys in Rancho Cucamonga. Hema Zamaro is a mother of two and an economist at the University of Arkansas and at USC, and she's done a lot of research into how the pandemic has affected mothers. And Thea Monnier is a family therapist and the mother of three teenage girls in Pasadena. Just before the break, she told us that even before the pandemic, moms were stressed with too much falling on their shoulders. But obviously, the pandemic has made it worse. So how to help moms in this particular moment? Do they just have to hold on and soldier through and hope that things get better? Or what are some coping strategies?
You know, ironically, one of my favorite coping strategies for moms right now is to be more like their kids. Kids are way more resilient than adults. And kids are creative and kind of naturally tend to be optimistic. And what about this? What about that? And they're experimental and they're explorative. And these are all qualities that would serve us very well right now, right? To think about, okay, this doesn't work. We can't do this, but what can we do? And to say yes a little more than we're used to saying no. I think also admitting to kids that we don't know everything and that we may not have those answers very soon, but here are the things that we do know. We do know that we love each other. We do know that we're here. We're going to do our very best and that we're in this together. And so just kind of releasing that authoritative role of all knowing and just admitting what we don't know, joining with our families in the I don't know in some ways can still allow mothers and their children and their families to have a degree of joy that's not dependent on whether or not we wear the mask or the mandates change or, you know, whatever it is, the news story is for that day.
How are you doing personally as a mom of teenage girls?
Teenage girls, right? You know, I surprisingly learned to thrive during this time. That's not to say that it hasn't been very complex, but that allowing myself to finally kind of shed some of that mythology has liberated me as a woman. So I've got to be a lot more human this year than I typically allow myself to be.
Give me an example of how you, of what you did. How did you do that?
Yeah. So, you know, my daughters said, you know, I would like to start cooking mainly because I'm tired of you cooking the same things because you're stressed out. I would like to like take on some of the cooking, right? And before, I think I had some feelings about that, right? Like, you know, well, you have school and I should be able to do this. And I should be able to do all these things. I should be able to do all of them well. But surrendering that to her has been the biggest blessing, and being honest about the fact that I ain't taking that back. Like after this pandemic, you still gonna be in that kitchen has been like really great and allowed her to like claim some space in our household as she's getting older. All right. It will be on her own in a few years. And it gave me a chance to like say, okay, there are things in my family that people here can hold. I do not have to hold everything. And so that's what I've been doing. Like, what don't I have to hold? What can people in this household also hold? How can they hold me? How can they take care of me? How can I be more honest about what I need and have more of a balanced relationship with them?
And does that include your husband? Like, is he stepping up?
Oh, yes. Well, we know that is, you know, the kids are a little easier sometimes. But yeah, like I've had to have some real conversations about, I'm not this like very godmother. Like, you know, when you wake up in the morning and things are together and they're stable, it's because I did that the night before or the day before. And it's time for us to like strip back the illusion that it's just sort of happening and look and see the gears and the energy and the time and the sweat and the tears that made those things happen. And so I've had to like, you know, basically reveal the Wizard of Oz, right? This is the wizard. I'm the wizard. Now, the wizard is tired. The wizard is tapping out. Other people are going to have to step in here and make something happen. And so, yeah, you know, little by little, everybody's like finding their space and their way to help out. It's a big load we carry, so it's going to take a little time, but I'm grateful for this shift.
Yeah. Well, Jessica, you mentioned earlier that men in general haven't really stepped up during this pandemic. How come?
It's complicated. I've talked to a lot of sociologists, and the number one reason that keeps coming up is that during times of crisis, you often see families reverting to old-fashioned gender roles because they are familiar. And so I think in this moment where nobody knew what to do, going back to moms being sort of classical moms felt like a comfortable dress that families could just climb into. So I think that's the biggest reason. Some dads have stepped up. You know, I've heard from readers, I got a couple notes from dads who said, I had no idea how much my wife was doing. And I was like, how could you have no idea? Did you not open your eyes in that house? But still, anything that sort of could illuminate and show honesty and really plumb the depths of how hard lots of people, partnered people were working, I think did move the needle in some families. But there's so many structural ways that push against fathers being fully involved. And I mean, just one example, something I hear over and over again, and you see reflected in the statistics, is that mothers are less punished if they take time to care for family than fathers are by their employers. And so those sorts of gender roles are just continue to be reinforced by everyone around us. And sort of another example, and this was pre-pandemic, but I heard it during the pandemic as well, families that really strive to have more egalitarian balance had to train the people around them. So for example, the dentist keeps calling the mom and is like, can we schedule an appointment? And the mom has to say, call the dad over and over again. And so moms are even having to do that work of retraining people around them. So it is sort of all sorts of systems that are encouraging moms to take on a greater role.
Right. And so that's something that you have called the motherhood penalty.
Yeah. Sociologists call the motherhood, the motherhood penalty specifically is that mothers are penalized at work when they have children, whereas fathers are elevated. And so there's actually some data from the pandemic that shows that fathers were the least laid off group of people. So in those early months of the pandemic, mothers, women without children, and men without children were laid off at about the same rates. And fathers were laid off at a rate of about 5% less than those other groups, because people have that sort of breadwinner image in their mind of that's what fathers are.
Mm-hmm. Hema, as people discuss returning to work, and I know this is being delayed because of the Delta variant, but are employers now readjusting and talking about making more accommodations for working mothers?
Yeah, so I get the impression that that might not be the case, and that's something that worries me. I feel there is a big push, or maybe there was the hope before Delta, we will come back to normal, and this is something we did for a bit, and in some employers are pushing hard to going back, kind of forgetting. So I think like it will be important moving forward to keep some of the flexibility that parents had during the pandemic, because as we were discussing, this is not something new. I think this is something that it has been there before. Parents struggle, moms take, even before the pandemic, they were taking much more of the share of childcare and housework than that. And so the pandemic just saw us this in a stream situation. So I think my feeling is that employers are moving forward forgetting about it. And I think it's very important for them not to forget and keep that type of flexibility moving forward, and especially with Delta around.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, I want to return back to you and talk about what is happening with you economically and with your job and your work as we are entering yet another phase of this pandemic. Where do you see your job and your career going as the kids go back to school?
For me, I'm hoping that the product-based things that I've put a little bit more emphasis on the last few months kind of take off and put me in a better position. I've kind of looked at the catering with events and people. For me right now with the Delta variant and seeing how things are changing again so quickly, I just don't think it's wise for me to put all of my eggs in that basket, if you will, because things are still opening, things are starting to shut down again, and that's just really unstable. So I was able to finish a cookbook that I had been working on. And so for me, I'm just believing that switching things around and kind of pushing myself to be a little bit more creative in the food area, which I'm versed in a lot of different things, but I just hadn't really put effort into doing it. I'm hoping that those are the things that kind of take off and put me in a better position. One of the things that I had an issue with also was, you know, there's a lot of people hiring and different things like that, but with childcare being an expense, if I have to leave and go work another job, and then also the amount of years that I did put into the workforce to set myself up to be able to have my own business and have my own company and be home with my children, that was something I wasn't willing to give up. I put a lot of years into that. And so for a pandemic that's been a year and a half to say, oh, I'm just going to throw away all the 15 years that I put into building my company to walk away from it from a job that won't even pay me enough to live, I'm just not willing to make that sacrifice.
So, I mean, how have you survived monetarily?
Well, surprisingly, with the moratorium here in California, we were only forced to pay 25% of our rent in order to stay in our places and to not be evicted, which was a pretty reasonable amount for me, which was great. I took the money that I got from the pandemic unemployment assistance and just budgeted that these last couple of year and a half. And so being a mom that's been at home for the last 12 years, I know how to budget really well. And, you know, with food and bills and different things like that, I don't really have a high amount of bills and debt. So we've been able to make it, which has been something I'm very grateful for.
But Jessica, this really does illustrate how much we're on our own in many instances, trying to cobble it together and figure it out. There's not a lot of structural support for moms or for anyone in crisis in this country.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's really showing as we try to return our kids to school in the fall and return them to care situations. You know, childcare was already in pretty rough shape before the pandemic, but it's a real mess now. I'm hearing places that had wait lists of 20 now have wait lists of 200 for daycare or aftercare for elementary school kids. And in other places, there is an abundance of childcare spots and not enough people who can afford to use them. And so I think we are entering this fall. There's not that much progress from where we were 6 months ago. There's a lot of progress from where we were 12 months ago because we have a vaccine, and hopefully children under 12 will be able to be vaccinated in the next couple months. And I think that emotionally will give parents a lot of relief. But in terms of the larger structures that could help hold us up in this moment where everything feels unsteady, they're just not there.
But why aren't they there? This is a moment where everyone said, okay, this is our big moment to change everything because we haven't seen a crisis like this in, you know, generations. And there's a new administration and there's a Democratic Congress. So why hasn't there been bigger change on this score?
It's very hard to create a structure from the ground up. So if you're just talking about childcare specifically, there was a moment in 1971 where a federal childcare bill could have been signed into law, passed both houses of Congress, and President Nixon vetoed it. And in the intervening 50 years, there has not been much energy on the federal level to create a whole system of care, which is what you would need to provide consistent care for people. And so even though it is much more popular, and I would say broadly popular, and I have heard energy even from Republicans who don't often support big entitlement plans like this, it will take a lot of time to create a structure that before was just a patchwork of individual solutions across the country. So I think I am optimistic in the sense that we are finally talking about childcare again, but to create an actual workable system and a funding system that could work could take a decade at best. So, you know, it's not something you can just kind of pull out of thin air.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with a quartet of moms from across the country about how the pandemic has affected them and whether or not we'll come out of this reexamining the role of motherhood and how society treats moms. Hema, when you look at the economics of this, what are the long-term consequences for women economically? Can they make up the lost money, the lost stature at work, or is that lost?
I hope it can be made up, but I worry that as this pandemic continues, this can really represent a step back and in terms of gender equality in the labor market. I think what we have seen is that, yes, employment for women and for mothers have recovered a little bit during the spring, and but not fully. And I worry that in the fall, with all the uncertainties like Delta and potentially more school closures or daycare closures, it's just all that uncertainty. We might start seeing women leaving employment again. Those that decided to go and get a new job might find it very hard to cope if we have more closures and childcare needs again. So again, as this continues, I really worry because I feel that this has really the potential to represent a very big step back for women.
Yeah. Thea, I want to ask you about how race factors into this conversation, because this was not just, the time of a pandemic. It was also a year of reckoning with systemic racism. Of course, we saw that people of color disproportionately affected by the disease, but also there were, you know, the uprisings and the reckonings that were happening with police shootings, with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, et cetera. So putting all that together, how is that affecting Black women, women of color, their mental health?
Well, I love what you were discussing with Jessica, because the truth is mental health is sort of a litmus test of the values of a society. It'll reflect if a society is actually living according to its values, right? And so we cannot overturn, you know, centuries, decades of sexism, racism, wealth inequities in a year and a half. And that is the true reason why we can't get back to some form of functionality, because we did not design a country that put well-being at the forefront. All of that is showing a direct correlation with the rise in mental health symptoms. And you're right, per usual, when you add the layer of race to it, that's another complication, right, that any Black parent is going to have to deal with, because I had to have conversations with my kids about the uprisings. We had to process anger, process grief. We had to process, I remember the day that the Breonna Taylor verdict came back, and, you know, the emotions and looking at your kids and trying to explain this horrific thing that makes no sense, that shouldn't exist in the middle of a pandemic, is something that no one should have to do. The other thing we saw was, you know, there was so much social awareness about it, right? There was companies putting out ads, and it was beautiful, and we knew, those of us who were involved in that game, we knew, we were like, come next year, we're not going to hear anything from these folks, right? And sure enough, the numbers have gone down, and people who are signing up to learn about this thing, because we only have trained ourselves to respond to crisis, and this is our problem. We don't know how to sustain a peaceful, equitable society, because we're trained to only think about what do people need in a crisis situation, as opposed to what do we need ongoingly so that we don't end up in crisis. Because there are things that could happen. I was on a call for a conference in Lagos, and they were pointing out that, like, say, for instance, in the Caribbean, you're not seeing suicide rates go up the way they are going up in other areas, right? But, you know, that's a very collective space, right? You know, they function as a community. It's a smaller community, yes, granted, but also, you know, they're very clear, we're all going to lock this down. We have some states that will, some states that won't. We have red states, blue states, blah, blah. And even now, the language is to separate, right? The unvaccinated, the vaccinated. Our go-to is always separation. And it's really the thing that's going to continue to keep us not just in a pandemic, but in a crisis mind state as a country.
Right. Well, given all that, I'm going to try to end on a hopeful note. And I want to ask each of you how this pandemic has changed you as mothers personally. And Thea, let me just begin with you.
I definitely am grateful because my children are a little older. They're 17, 16, and 13. And we've been doing the go to work, go to school routine for their whole existence. And this year I got to slow down and spend a lot of quality time with them before they launch into the world. So for me, it taught me to slow down tremendously, to really enjoy my motherhood and to shape it around my joy, not just theirs.
That's lovely. Emma?
Yeah, so for me, I think the experience of having to do a schooling from home really opened my eyes to how my kids learn and like how they really are as students, which I think is something that I was missing when they were going to school. And also I would say another positive for me, I feel like as a working mom, I used to have very separate lives between like mom and my employee. And now everything was at home and everything was out there and mess up. And I think that made me realize that, you know, I have to be upfront with my colleagues of my needs as a mom. And I'm more open at that. And my kids also see me as a professional and working, and they get a better sense of what I do. So I think that's been the positive for us.
Jessica?
Mine are very similar in that I have been lucky enough to be able to work from home during this pandemic, and just being able to see my daughters every day and throughout the day has been just a joy that I would never want to give up. We did not get to have dinner together every night before the pandemic. Now we do. My younger daughter at the beginning of the pandemic was 3. She will be my last baby. And to get to be closer to her in that last gasp of babyhood and little girlhood, it's priceless. I would never want to give that up. So I feel like I understand my children more. I know them better. And that knowledge and closeness is just wonderful. And I think in some ways it is more difficult to have younger kids because they need so much more hands-on care, but in another way, they actually like being around you. So I have been very grateful to have kids the age of my kids in a lot of ways.
And Jennifer, how has this past year and a half changed you as a mom?
It has definitely changed me in a sense of realizing the importance of me being a mom hands-on to my children. It's something that I knew when I left the workforce a long time ago that I really wanted, but being home more and more every single day, day in and day out, you know, as long as we have, it's just really taught me to embrace the relationships with my children and to see the gifts and talents that they have and different things that I want to invest and spend more time in and to pour into them, which I wouldn't normally see when I'm so busy working. And so it's been a blessing for me, even though it's been a little difficult, but I wouldn't trade that time for anything. And it taught me too, as a mom, that we are strong, we are resilient. And really when we're pushed to the test, we can do anything. And so it may not have been easy to, you know, rearrange things and put things in new order, how we run our households and jobs, but I did it and we did it. And so the fact that we're still here on the other end of this, we may not have all the answers, but we're still going. And for me, that's a big deal.
We heard from Jennifer Haynes, caterer and single mom in Rancho Cucamonga, Jessica Gross, New York Times parenting columnist and author of the forthcoming book, All Powerful and Totally Useless, The Creation of the Ideal American Mother, Hema Zamaro, an economist at the University of Arkansas and at USC, and Thea Monnier, a family therapist in Pasadena. Thank you all for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all. Take care of yourselves.
Yes, thank you so much.
Hang in there.
Yeah.
We got this, guys.
Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, who produced our story on the moms, Rosalie Atkinson, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you for listening. I'll see you on Monday.